Welcome to the Packet Pushers Podcast, the data networking industry podcast where folks who build networks for a living gather in the virtual conference room to exchange opinions, talk technology, and chat with excellent industry guests. So today, the topic is the start of a dive into the depths of the Cisco Nexus platform. This is something that we've been talking about doing for actually into a couple of months now. We've been kicking the idea around, and what we're seeing is such a groundswell of people that are taking the leap over into Cisco Nexus that we said, yeah, let's talk about it. Let's talk about our experiences. Let's get a handle on what we've been doing, what we've learned. And just have an open conversation about it on the podcast. So we've got a show today that's going to be focused kind of the rudiments, some foundations of dealing with Cisco Nexus. We're going to talk about the hardware, where it's positioned, and a lot of the considerations around the different hardware that Cisco's presented in the Nexus line. So if you're listening to this and you have no idea who I am Ethan Banks. I'm a network engineer, a CCIE, and I blog at packetpushers.net, which I call home. That is the home base for this show as well. We have bloggers up there as well as all the podcasts right on the front page and lots of great content. You can follow me on Twitter also at EC Banks and also on LinkedIn or share with me on Google+. And I got three other guys that have been doing a lot of Nexus work here as Cisco customers doing deployments that have joined us for the show. And the first one up is Chris Margit. Chris, why don't you introduce yourself and tell folks a bit about your Nexus background and how they can follow you.
All right. Thanks, Ethan. Yep, I'm Chris Margit. I'm a consultant. I work for a Cisco reseller. I've been working with the Nexus products since 2009. And have done deployments in a variety of customers, financial, manufacturing, biotech, those kind of things. So I've been working with it for a while. I am on the Twitter at Chris Margit, and I have a blog, which is fragmentationneeded.net.
Excellent. Thank you very much for making the time on this this Friday afternoon to join us. And also joining us is Mr. Jeff Fry. Say hello, Jeff, and tell folks about yourself.
Hey, Ethan, Chris, and Tone. I'm Jeff Fry. I worked with Nexus for the past couple of years, done data center deployments. Previous company I worked for, we did a couple 7,000 deployments. When I was leaving there, we did a couple Nexus 5,000 deployments. I'm now working for a large service provider who's looking at doing a Nexus 7,000, 5,000, 2,000 type design and having lots of fun with that. You can find me on my blog at fryguy.net and Twitter, I'm at fryguy_PA.
Awesome. And then last but not least, Mr. Tony Matke. Say hi, Tony.
As you guys know, I'm not just a Nexus Enterprise user, but I'm also a consultant. I spent the past couple of years building a Greenfield data center, taking advantage of Cisco Nexus, NetApp, and UCS. You can find me on Twitter at T-O-N-H-E or follow my rantings on the Packet Pushers blog or at routerjockey.com.
So we spent about 2 hours trying to plan this series out, just sitting down, what should we be talking about with Nexus? And the topic list kept getting longer and longer and longer. So realistically, you know, there's still up in the air just how deep we're going to get into this and how much we're going to cover because, man, there's a lot of it. So the plan at this point, we are looking at a show today where we really just cover hardware, a little bit about licensing, discuss optics and some of the considerations there, planning for maybe thinking about heat, power draw a little bit, how you can mount some of these things, the fact that some of these you can do converged storage with, and again, really more of a foundational kind of program. And then in future shows, we're not quite sure how many we're going to do yet because there is so much to talk about, but we're going to focus on more on the use case and design challenges built around Cisco Nexus. There's some new technologies there, there's new considerations, things you got to think about when you're doing a Nexus deployment. Things like virtual port channel, things like Fabric Path or Trill if you're running that. Challenges dealing with LACP spread across multiple FEXs and how you would design for that and so on. This is a lot. Today, if you are a data center shop, anywhere from small to even medium-sized enterprises can take advantage of Nexus, all the way up to the very largest data center, there's a good chance you're aware of the Cisco Nexus product line. If you're in the smaller shops, maybe you've got a Cisco Catalyst, maybe a 6000 you've got out there, 6500 that you're using today, and you're maybe looking at upgrading. You know the 6500 is kind of coming to the end of its very long life. and the Soup2T is about it, and you're not sure you even want to go there because you're looking at more needing more 10 gig density. So you're a potential user for Nexus, or maybe you've got some Nexus in already to deal with that. If you're looking at building a brand new data center, you're, again, probably not looking at Catalyst. If you're looking at the Cisco product line, you're probably looking at Nexus, so you can scale that out as big as you might need it. Going back to the smaller shops, it's possible that you may be looking at Nexus and going, I don't think I need a 7,000. I think I only need a 5,000 or 5,500. And with some 2K fexes, there's a lot of scenarios here where Cisco will slot Nexus in to meet your needs. And that is more what they seem to be pushing these days, as opposed to putting customers back into Catalyst. So there's a whole lot of drive that's been going on in Cisco marketing, and a whole lot of additions to the Nexus product set that have been made. As Chris said, he's been doing Nexus since 2009. I saw my first Nexus in, I think, 2008, installing a pair of 7010s early in the day, and of course the product line has expanded quite a bit. So what I thought we'd do here, just to kind of kick off this discussion, is talk about the first major change between Nexus and say, Catalyst, if you're familiar with that, is the operating system. The operating system that we know and love in the Catalyst line would be iOS SX. Well, love it or maybe not love it, just depending. Now, there's a change here when you get into the Nexus line, which is NXOS. And it is iOS-like in many ways, but there are also a lot of differences in both what you see at the command line and then how it's built underneath. And Jeff, you want to kick us off and talk a bit about that?
Yeah, I was doing some research in NXOS because it is a pretty different operating system than iOS. What was actually kind of curious was NXOS was actually built off SanOS, the Storage Area Network Operating System, and that actually dates back to 2002. I didn't realize SanOS actually went back that far. So when you start thinking about how long development's been actually on NXOS, it's actually longer than the 2008 timeframe when it started to ship with the 7010s or the 7000s. So it kind of surprised me it actually was as old as it actually is.
Yeah, that's one of the actually the selling points that the Cisco reps have given me about NXOS is, A, it's built on SanOS, which is a proven operating system that's got a long history, and it's, you know, they were talking about how stable and so on it is. Don't snicker too loudly. Okay.
Yeah, the other thing that was kind of cool, it's actually built for the data center. I mean, it's built for high availability with ISSU. It's designed for accepting new features, like when they introduced Lisp or OTV recently. It's pretty modular, where getting stuff like that in iOS tends to take major revisions and a lot of other changes, but with the NXOS, it just enables the feature once it's there. It's kind of nice. I mean, I like it for that. The other thing that's nice about NXOS is it's on more than just one type of platform. Like iOS for 2600s isn't quite the same as a 7200, or nowhere near the same as an ASR with iOS XR code stuff. So NXOS is the same across 5K, 7K, 1Ks, MD5s. It's once you get in it, you kind of know where you're at.
Now, I'm just getting started with my Nexus stuff, so I'm dealing with 5Ks, and then, of course, the fexes, you don't manage the fexes. They're managed by the 5Ks or 7K. All your experience, guys, is that's true? The NXOS experience is homogenous across hardware platforms?
To the extent that the feature you're looking for is available on the platform, you know, the ones that are there, in my experience, are pretty much the same across all of them.
Yeah, there's a few feature differences that are like the 7K gets MPLS and Lisp. I don't think the 5K gets MPLS. And then you got the 1000, which only got some lower level features, layer 2s and stuff.
Yeah, and not all the NXOS code releases have been coming out at the same time, I noticed. Like, I saw an announcement for NSOX 602 or 3 or something released recently, and I thought, oh, that's what I'll go to in my 5500s. Yeah, no, I won't. It's only available in the 7Ks right now. So, okay, so Jeff, you mentioned something a minute ago, which was you can just turn on and off certain features, which from an iOS perspective, that's a foreign concept. I mean, the closest I can think of that Cisco got to that with the 6500 was when they had the iOS modularity code trains, which didn't survive. They didn't go all that long, and you ended up back at monolithic for Safe Harbor releases anyway. They weren't recommending modular anymore, last I had checked. So talk a bit about that turning features on and off.
Yeah, like with some of the stuff you have, I mean, we're going to obviously talk about a lot of the stuff in more detail. Feature of like VDCs, the virtual device context to create a virtual switch. By default, it's not there. You actually need to enable the feature VDC to turn a lot of that stuff on. Telnet's a feature. I mean, by default, I think SSH is enabled, but Telnet's not. So if you try to Telnet to the switch, you need to enable Telnet. These switches come pretty secure out of the box for that feature, but most people turn Telnet on and not worry about it.
I'm constantly getting surprised by the feature business. You know, every time I go to do something new, and what the heck, why can't I enable an SVI on the switch? Or, you know, why can't I turn on, you know, HSRP or policy routing or whatever it is?
Yeah, but I mean, it's kind of nice though this way, because if you're not using it, at least it's not running in the operating system and causing any issues.
Well, I just smack my forehead every time and turn it on.
It's called job security, right?
but it's a good thing, right? Exactly, in that the fewer features we have to turn on in our hardware or in our software to drive our hardware is a good thing, because in theory that means we have a more robust, resilient system there. Fewer things that can leak memory, fewer things that can be buggy, crash, or expose a security vulnerability. So in my mind, that's a good thing, yeah?
Yeah, except for like some of the stuff that, I mean, you put one of these switches in, you expect to be able to do interface VLANs, but no, it's a feature you have to turn on.
Okay. So, yeah, okay. Even the most basic stuff. Yeah, I get it. No, I went through, I've got a couple of 5500s up in a lab with Fexus Plum that I had to turn some features on just to get the Fexus to work. So that, yeah, I'm starting to get in that mindset myself.
Yeah, I mean, it would be nice to see some intelligence. Hey, that's this plugged in. We should know we need this. But unfortunately, for the same thing, though, security-wise, if it's not there, then nobody can use it. So if you get somebody unexperienced plugging in or inexperienced plugging something in, at least you know they're not going to crash the switch.
Now, have any of you guys done anything with the virtualization that NXOS offers? Because you can basically run virtual device contacts on a Nexus box and have segmented operating systems, if you will, network environments living on the same hardware. Just curious if any of you had a chance to deploy that.
I use it at a couple of different customers, and yeah, it's great. It's like you have a separate switch, you know, different administrators, different management IP addresses, a different 12-bit VLAN space. It's like a whole new switch.
And it's nice because you can actually, if you buy a 32-port 10-gig card, you can at least carve it up between VDCs instead of burning that much money on a per-switch basis. You don't need multiple 10-gig switches. You can take one and carve it up.
Yeah, even better, if you run a, you know, you have a Nexus, if you're fortunate enough to have a Nexus in your lab, you can actually run multiple VDCs on it, do, you know, VPCs between those VDCs, even so that's not supported in production. It's still a viable option for your lab.
Now, is it like with a VRF where you configure an interface, assign it to a VRF, it's committed to that VRF? I assume it's the same thing here with a VDC.
Sort of. You actually have to manage that interface from a separate instance of, I'd almost say a separate instance of NXOS running. You actually have to get into that VDC to manage it.
Right, because that interface is assigned to that VDC and that VDC only. It's not shared.
Gotcha. Right. Yeah. It's not right. Yeah.
Except in the case of, I think it starts to change in the F2 line cards, where it starts to muddy the water because of the fiber channel capability of them. There's a whole different level of. We can talk about them later.
Yeah.
That's a whole nother conversation.
So I think the big point to take away here regarding NXOS is it's not iOS. It is a different beast. It is modular in nature as opposed to monolithic, which is typically what you come from with iOS. And so you have an opportunity to run a data center switch that has just the features you need as opposed to a whole lot of stuff that you don't necessarily want, and that could cause problems for you. So that's an improvement. That's a good thing with NXOS.
Yeah, it also means you don't have that vulnerability that may exist in something with iOS because it's always in the code. If you're not running it, that vulnerability doesn't exist, theoretically, in the code if you don't have the feature turned on.
Now, I think one of the selling points there, too, is that if something is broken in the code, the whole thing doesn't have to crash. It can be just spanning tree or just OSPF that crashes, and other stuff might keep running.
Right, well, even, yeah, like if OSPF crashes, it'll reload. It'll actually keep forwarding packets because of nonstop forwarding, if I remember correctly, and it'll reload the database from the neighbor without dropping and reconverging, correct?
But you don't have to reload the whole chassis.
Right. You just, the process restarts.
Yeah, that's like, new and good.
Yeah, it's like XR. XR just restarts the process and just keeps on going.
Now, all that said about NXOS as being pluses, there are just one notable minus, which is not unique to NXOS. It's still got bugs. There are still bugs that people are victimized by. There's still an obligation that you have as a designer to do a bug scrub on the NXOS code that you're looking to deploy. Consider what feature sets you're looking to turn on, and then see what might be a problem for you. It is not a bug-free operating system, unfortunately. And I've seen plenty of activity on Twitter with people complaining about this bug or that bug that's bit them. And I think there's another point worth making, which is you don't necessarily have feature parity with iOS either. Not every feature for a given function that you would have in iOS is necessarily there in NXOS. So it's not a one-for-one thing. And in fact, some people have made the point that while NXOS is great in the data center at the core, where you don't necessarily need a super rich feature set because your biggest focus is just forwarding packets as fast as you possibly can around the data center. And if you want super rich features, then what you maybe need to consider is still iOS on the Catalyst 6500. Would you guys agree with me on that?
100%. Like you're saying, the feature set is not complete, but it is developing as we move on. We just added MPLS within the last year, and we're getting closer with every single revision.
Yeah, it's taking its time, but I mean, it's nice to have separate certain feature functions out of a data center versus some of the features that you're going to, like even MPLS is pushing to the data center, but it's one of those that's still kind of new pushing to the data center. How do you handle that? So yeah. It is kind of nice having things a little bit, having a segmentation like that and having to have something else.
So, well, I mean, with that, why don't we start talking about the hardware bit, which is really what we wanted to focus on today anyway. When you get into the Nexus product line and you get a look, which you can go to cisco.com/go/Nexus, that will dump you to the Cisco homepage for the Nexus products. Well, really, it's more of a generic page that talks about like data center switching, but most of the Nexus gear is there. You've got several major lines of products, which each of which we're going to walk through in some detail here. The big daddy, if you will, is the Nexus 7000 line. The Nexus 7000 is a big chassis, very big, and he's again a chassis. You slot line cards into it. It's hardware modularity. You can mix and match what it is you want to put in this thing. It weighs a ton. It's a beast. It throws a lot of heat around, and it's a very serious piece of networking gear that you would position at the core layer. Next up from that, you would have Nexus 50, the 5K, the 5000 series, which is two flavors. The original ones were the 5010 and the 5020. Now we have 5548s and 5596s, which give you some different speeds and feeds depending which platform you're looking at, and some different functionality for the optics depending on what you're putting in there. And then there's some oddball ones, the Nexus 4000 and 3000, which we'll mention when we get to those. And then the 2000 is not a standalone product. The Nexus 2000 line is a series of what Cisco calls fabric extenders. A fabric extender, as in, it's not a switch. And you think, well, sure, it's a switch. It's a top-of-rack switch. But it doesn't do anything by itself. If you take a Nexus 2000 FEX, put it in top-of-rack, plug things in, nothing happens. The FEX architecture is such that you have to have it plumbed up to either a 5000 series or, in a more limited case, the 7000 series. Not every line card in a 7000 supports a FEX uplink. Only certain line cards do. So for that FEX to do anything, you need to have it plumbed to a 5000 or a 7000, and even traffic going from one FEX port to another FEX port on the same FEX is going to travel down to the 5000 to 7000 and get turned back around again so that it can be forwarded. So we'll talk about that more when we get there. The Nexus 1000, which we've talked about on the podcast before, is a software switch. And then at the very bottom of the show here, we're just going to mention some of the management software that's related to managing a Nexus environment. So, Mr. Margaret, why don't we start off with you, and let's talk about the big guys, the Nexus 7000s.
Okay, Nexus 7000, it's a big Layer 3 chassis. It's something you might use where you would have used a 6500 before. There are three chassis in this family, the 18-slot, 10-slot, and 9-slot chassis. The 18 slot guy is big. 16 payload slots, that's slots for line cards. Sideways airflow means, you know, there's rack ducting considerations and that kind of thing. It's the biggest one. The 10 slot chassis, is exactly half a rack. I've seen them racked, it's 21 rack units. I've seen them racked, two to a rack, and boy, that was a lot of cables. It does front to back cooling, which is nice and helpful because most data centers are set up for that.
Yeah, front to back, as in for a true hot aisle, cold aisle design.
Hot, cold. To do it with the 7018, you know, there's special cabinets. Pandua makes one that's officially blessed by Cisco. And it's got these, you know, massive ducts on the side to turn it into hot, cold aisle rather than cook your neighbor.
Yeah. right.
Finally, there's the 7009, which is a new chassis. It is designed to be a exact replacement for someplace you might have a 6509 right now. Nine slots, seven for payload. Same airflow as the 6509. It goes right in that same spot. The major deviation from the 6509 is that the fan is around back, which is really welcome change. On all these 7Ks, the power supplies, the supervisors, and the line cards are shared by all of them. Fans and fabric modules are unique to each chassis. They don't interchange.
Yeah, there's a form factor challenge with the fans and the fabric modules. But yeah.
Exactly right, because you know the fabric's got to connect to every card, and some of the chassis, the cards are sideways, some of them they're up and down. So, you know, there's differences there.
Now, just a quick question here. There's been some rumors about other size chassis. Have anybody either heard mention of this or care to comment on that?
I cannot confirm nor deny.
Okay. there isn't anything official that I've seen from Cisco, but suffice it to say, there have been rumors of chassis smaller than the 7009 that
only
may
what I've
be
seen
coming.
In the MIBS.
Right. Yes. Oh, you blogged about that, didn't you?
Yes, I did. I wrote about that and had some interesting conversations caused by that. Yes.
Yes. So anyway, not that we know anything official, but keep your ear to the ground for maybe like a 7006 or maybe a 7003 or something coming eventually at some point. And if Cisco's undecided about that, of course, it's going to be like anything. It's going to be driven by customer demand. So, all right. Now, Chris, three different chassis, all of which have interchangeable line cards that would go on the front, not interchangeable for the fabric cards or the power supply. So now somebody might be listening to this and going, well, what the heck is a fabric card?
So the power supplies actually do interchange, but the fabrics do not. So the fabric modules are, unlike on a 6500 where your switching fabric is on the supervisor, these guys have five modular fabrics. These are, you know, walk around the back, or in the case of the 7009, the front, and pull them out. It's a replaceable unit, five slots. Each fabric module provides bandwidth to each line card. So the fabric one provides 46 gig to every line card. So if you have one of them, you got 46 gig of switching capacity on each card. Two of them, 46. Fill that chassis out, you get 230 gig of switching capacity.
So in other words, you can use the fabric cards to scale out the oversubscription that you're willing to put up with coming out of each line card slot?
You probably would not do it that way because, I mean, you could undersize the fabric, but the fabric compared to the rest of it is pretty inexpensive. So
yeah, but from a standpoint of understanding what the fabric cards are actually offering here, you're probably going to slam your chassis full of fabric cards. If it takes five, you're going to put five in it. But in effect, what you're losing or what you're causing is when you take fabric cards away, is you're increasing the oversubscription rate of the line card going into the backplane.
That's right. So you reduce the bandwidth available to each card. Now, I do have a bunch of 7000s in production with just three fabric modules, and that's because they're filled with 80 gig cards. So two fabric modules is enough to fully supply those cards, and the third one's there for redundancy, and then there's two open slots. So depending on what's in there, you might not need five. So anyway, the first Fab 1 gives 46 gig per slot. The Fab 2 supplies 110 gig per slot. depending on which card. You know, some of the cards require all the bandwidth the fabric can supply. So in that case, a loss of a fabric module would mean reduced capacity.
And it's worth mentioning that when you're going to buy a Nexus chassis, it's going to come bundled with some amount of fabric cards. I haven't seen a bundle where you can get it without fabric cards. Maybe there is one. But typically, I've seen bundles, I think, with three and with five fabrics. And nowadays, I think it's fair to say you want to be in Fab 2.
Yeah, the Fab 1 and the Fab 2 interoperate, so you have a live upgrade path. But really, there's no reason not to buy the Fab 2.
Yeah. And as you pointed out, it's not... That's not going to be the major expense of this purchase. Not
goodness, no.
Yeah.
all right. So there's a lot of line card choices. Generally speaking, there are four line cards, one of which is not shipping yet, as far as I can tell. The original cards were M1, they're referred to as, and there's a few different models. These are layer 3 capable, 80 gig on the fabric interconnect. And you can buy them with or without XL capability, which means the same thing as it did on DFCs for catalysts.
Effectively, more TCAM space?
Exactly, more TCAM space. The difference here is that an upgrade doesn't require you to pull the card out and install the upgrade. The upgrade is now a license. So swipe your credit card and get more TCAM.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I did not know that. Oh, I feel dirty.
not all of them have that built in, but or at least not the early ones. But I think now everything has the XL capability. Just maybe it isn't licensed.
Actually, if you're buying M1 cards, still make sure you buy the XL card, because the cost difference is zero.
Right.
So right, the cost is the same. Buy the card, upgrade later if you need it.
The XL license is per chassis, and it costs more for the larger chassis, because you know the feature might be turning on the XL capability for 16 cards in the largest chassis.
TCAM, by the way, just dawned on me. I don't think any of us mentioned what the point of it is. It allows you to hold things like MAC addresses and routes and access control list entries, these kind of things. It's very expensive high speed memory that lives on these cards.
Yeah, but that's the stuff that moves the packets. That's what makes it a switch and not a router, right?
Yeah.
anyway, in the M1 family, there's a M148. That's a 1 gig card with 48 ports. You can get it with an SFP interface that only does 1 gig, or you can get them with 10/100, 1000 copper. There's the M108, which is a line rate 10 gig card. It's got 8 ports in front and 80 gig in the back. And then there's the M132 card, which is exactly the same architecture as the M108, except that each 10 gig interface is fanned out into four interfaces. So you can run that thing as four oversubscribed ports on each ASIC, or you can set an ASIC into dedicated mode and use it at line rate.
Another thing to point out about these M1 cards, these are full-featured layer 3 cards. Now, if you're thinking back to the Catalyst line, the Supervisor engine had that functionality, and it was all on the iOS software, in your mind, more or less. The Soup engine with the PFC and the DFC cards dealt with all that. You weren't really worried about the line cards having this sort of functionality. If you wanted super fast performance, you might put a DFC card on, like a 6700 or something like that, so that line card could do some forwarding. But generally speaking, you didn't really worry about it. The Supervisor engine took care of it all. It's different here on a Nexus, where you have to make sure that the capabilities you're looking for this switch to perform for you are that it actually has these features in the line card, because the Soup engine doesn't automatically just give you that.
That is exactly the case. In fact, the next card I wanted to talk about, the F1, that's a 32-port 10-gig card, 1 gig or 10 gig on each port, and it's a layer 2 only card. I was just working through a design with a customer who wanted to turn up a new device context, and all they had was F2 ports they wanted to use, and that means there's no router in that switch. Yeah, you need some L3 capability, and it has to come from a card, either an M1 or an F2. So the F1 card, if you need to hop from VLAN to VLAN, the traffic goes into the fabric over to the M1 card, gets routed by that engine, passed back to the F1 card. That's a process called proxy routing. And there are cases where you might buy an M1 card, connect no cables to it, and just use it for proxy routing horsepower. The next card, the newest one that's shipping right now, is called an F2. It's a 48-port 10-gig card. It's Layer 2 and Layer 3 capable. Cisco says it has comprehensive Layer 3 features. I think that means there's a few things missing. I'm not sure on the specifics, but I wonder if MPLS and IPv6 and all of those things are really there right now.
I haven't looked at every feature, but I did ask Ron Fuller at Cisco about this, about the F2 cards, and as he put it, they are full tilt boogie. That was his terminology. So really? In theory, it's all there, but I haven't done a feature-by-feature comparison between F2s and the M series either.
I think some of the F2 limitations right now are actually based on the Soup 1. I think some of that gets resolved when the Soup 2, I found a blog post on NetCraftsman talking about some of the features of the F2 require the Soup 2. So it's kind of interesting the card's out before the supervisor.
Interesting. The F2 card does not play well with others. If you have an M1 or an F1 in a chassis, you can't put an F2 in there without breaking it into a new device context that is F2 only. But because it has Layer 3 and all this other capability on its own, this might be okay.
And then the big thing here, if you're pricing out a chassis of a 7K and you're trying to compare an M1 card to an F2 card, you might say, well, who cares? Well, you care because of the cost. I think an M1 lists out roughly 80K and an F2 roughly 40K, half of that, just depending. When I had checked the pricing last. So there is a big cost differential between the M series and the F series. So it's worth doing your homework and figuring out which one's going to meet your needs the best.
Yeah. And then the newest stuff is M2 cards. These are Layer 3 with either a pair of 100 gig interfaces or 640 gig interfaces. As far as I can tell, these are not orderable. I checked half an hour ago on the to see if it was on the price list, and it didn't appear. So I'm guessing that means you can't order one yet. So certainly never seen one.
Yeah, but the M2s are, again, going for the higher Ethernet speeds per port and so on. The big shops are going to have an interest in that, using like for beginner connects to different parts of the data center, that kind of thing. Well, I guess we're seeing more 40 gig, eh? But
I think you're going to, well, as the internet and Facebook continue to grow, the speeds are going to be required because everybody wants to watch the videos of the kids.
Yeah, that's right.
And stream their Netflix.
Any and all of you, regarding the 7000s, I'll just comment quickly on my experience putting a 7010 in a rack, is that this thing is a beast. We emptied the chassis of everything, power supplies, line cards, the whole thing, and it still took four of us to get this into a rack.
Did you take it off the pallet first or not?
Yeah. Yeah.
There's the trick. Leave it on the little pallet and then just lift it up a little bit.
I had to rack some of those by myself. Not fun.
They're literally hundreds of pounds. It is, I think it's 300 and something pounds unloaded, right?
And there's then a big warning sticker loaded on the side that says, don't attempt to pick this thing up even by its handles unless it's empty.
Yeah. It says requires beer muscles to move.
Yeah. No doubt.
So, I really want to see the people that have stacked two of these on top of each other. I have no idea how they got it up there.
Server lift.
Yeah, forklift.
Yeah.
Either that or maybe the first year guys.
Yeah. Hey, intern, come here.
Exactly.
Now, the other end of this thing is power. Now, these power supplies, they are, I believe, 6,000 watts, and they each have two inputs. So you can do an A and a B feed into each one of these power supplies. But it's, you're pulling in a lot of watts and a lot of amps for this thing, so your power infrastructure may need to be reviewed. You may need to pull new circuits in to cope with these things.
Yeah, I love that power design, though. This way, if you ever lose a feed, you don't actually lose a power supply. You just lose half the wattage, which is actually really nice.
But if you've got a 7000 chassis with three 6,000-watt power supplies with two feeds apiece, you're talking about six feeds to fully populate that thing.
Yeah, you're talking a lot of really thick 30-amp cabling.
You need to be careful, too, about exactly how that's designed. You know, there's the input source redundancy versus power supply redundancy. There's some papers out there describing it. But, losing half of your data center grid you know, might mean that each power supply drops to half capacity. And if you have things set up in redundant power mode, then the chassis will start powering down line cards. So you need to plan carefully for, you know, each failure scenario and how much power is going to be available in them. The six cords is just complicates life, in my opinion.
Yeah, well, we should probably mention there's also DC power supplies for some of these things. And DC is a whole different beast. But I think if I remember correctly, when I was looking at these, we were thinking about DC power when I did some of my deployments because the joys of working for a telecom. There actually is a panel you put on the rack and you tie everything to the panel. So it was actually kind of a nicer design, but it's still dangerous, if you ask me.
In addition to the 6,000-watt power supply, there's a 7,500. The bugger with that thing is, like the 6,500's 4-kilowatt power supply, the cord doesn't unplug from it, which means if you need to replace one, you need to fish that 16-foot-long cord, you know, through the rack, through the floor, with the giant plug on the end, and sometimes that can't be done because so much cabling's been installed after the fact.
So there's planning to put this beast into your data center, and it is... But it is what Cisco is positioning as the core switch that you can scale out hardware-wise. And there's rumors that they're going to put some kind of a services engine card maybe available for this thing someday. Of course, that's a big thing that's missing if you were to compare this to the Catalyst. With the Catalyst, you can put in the wireless, the WISM, the wireless module, and you can put in the firewall services module, and, there's a NAM module and so on. Most of that functionality that's just not there and isn't really targeted at the Nexus and wasn't planned early. But again, another one of those rumor things you hear that could be coming at some point. It could make sense. I dare say it's going to be in the form of a generic services module where you can, I don't know, it would be run a VM on it, or some sort of a virtualized service would be my suspicion for a card that's going to end up in a 7000 that can do that sort of functionality. We should move on now to the 5000s, and Tony, I believe you're up to start talking through that product set.
Okay, let's start with some of the newer offerings from Cisco. Currently, we have the Nexus 5596 and the 5548. These come in two different varieties. We have the UP models and the P models. Now, the difference here is we're talking about unified ports. Unified ports basically support Ethernet, fiber channel. They're actually more modular for, you know, connecting anything you need in that distribution layer. The 5596 UP has 48 unified SFP plus ports. Also has three modules that you can add to it. That will bring you up to a total of 96 ports. Those modules can be either native fiber channel or, again, more unified ports as well. That switch and the 5548 both can sustain throughput of 1.92 terabits a second.
Yeah, that's a non-blocking switch platform, in other words. It can forward at line rate. If you have the whole thing populated with, like, 10 gig Ethernet, it can do all of it. Yes, 960 gig in both directions for nearly 2 terabits per second of throughput. And again, in that unified port thing, I mean, that UP model, you can stuff any optic that you want in there, whether it's a storage optic or whether it's an Ethernet optic, and it's going to be okay. And correct me if I'm wrong, Tony, I can put a 1 gig optic in there as well, even if I wanted to.
That's correct. Whereas we'll talk about some of the older 5000s, the 5010 and the 5020, only the first 16 ports on those you were able to actually stuff a 1 gig optic into. Everything else was 10 gig only.
So the 96 is 2U, and the 48, or the 5596 UP is 2U, and the 5548 UP is 1U, but effectively they're the same switch.
Exactly. It's just another row of ports, basically, and some more module ports.
Yeah, that UP is all fixed in the 48 port, all fixed. Can't add any cards to it, but the 96 gives you the three slots.
So on the 5500 series, we have a couple expansion modules we can add. We have a Layer 3 routing engine. It's capable of 160 gig a second. Another 8-port, 10-gig unified port module as well. That covers it on those. The 5010 and the 5020 are the older generation of the 5000 series. Basically, again, the 1U and the 2U and the 5020. The 5020 has 56 total ports possible, 40 fixed, non-unified, 10 gigabit ports. Again, those are SFP plus. And then it has two expansion slots where the 5010 only has one. The modules for those, we pretty much cover 8-port FCOE module. So yeah, we have a 6-port SFP plus module that does 10 gigabit Ethernet. We have the 8-port fiber channel module, and then another 6-port fiber channel module as well.
All right. So I noticed you talked, as we were talking through all the hardware here for the 5500, the fiber channel and fiber channel over Ethernet came up quite a bit. The point being, the 5K, Cisco is positioning to let you do convergence. This is the converged storage play where they want you to be able to do both your data center Ethernet, or have it be native fiber channel, like fiber channel and a fiber channel dedicated SAN. You can run those ports as well. Or the one that's in the middle would be fiber channel over Ethernet. And, you know, none of the four of us are especially storage guys. But if you start digging into what the capabilities of the 5K are, Cisco is really positioning this switch to, again, for that convergence play, so that it becomes realistic then to carry your fiber channel storage traffic on this switch and have that make sense. Have that not be something that you have to shudder and think is all horrible and, oh my goodness, this could never work. It's a player here. And in fact, the UCS platform does exactly that, if I understand how they plug all those in together.
Yes, on UCS, it actually takes care of most of that for you. You plug in your fiber channel to the 6010 or 6020, and it actually handles all of the FCOE in the background. You don't even really have to configure much of anything other than your worldwide port names.
But then, yeah, I mean, the model numbers are a little different when they pop a Nexus switch into the UCS, but effectively it's the same thing in the back. But yeah, it just kind of illustrates the point that it can be done. I raise that point to say this: if you're working with the storage guys in your shop and you're trying to position Nexus and see what the best design might be, it's worth a conversation then to say, we're buying Nexus. Does it make sense to license these 5Ks for storage? And then if we do that, how do we want to do that? Do we want to go with converged network adapters on the server side that will let me do Ethernet and FCOE at the same time on the same port? Do we just want to have fiber channel ports kind of be dedicated off to the side here for an interconnection to the SAN? What makes sense?
The other nice thing about that also gives you a migration path where if your storage guys aren't ready for FCOE yet, you can sit there and still do standard storage and then break out to FCOE when they're ready.
Now, another thing here is, Tony, the last two switches, the 5010 and the 5020. Is there a reason I'm still buying those? Because they've been around for a while.
Honestly, I don't see any reason. Right now, they support fewer ports. They're less flexible. I honestly have a pair right now in one of my data centers that I want to get rid of. I want to move on to the 5548s and just make my life a little bit more consistent.
Yeah, you end up with the same form factor but a higher port density, you know, more switching fabric capacity, and then the unified port capability. And, mm-hmm. and you get rid of all that those limitations that the 5010 and the 5020 have. So there's a lot of real good benefits for going up to the 5500 series. So, and I know pricing-wise, does anybody happen to know, are you catching a break if you go with the older ones, like a 5010 or a 5020 instead of the 5500 series?
I've bought both and didn't do a direct comparison, but they're pretty similar. Any pricing break that might be there isn't worth the QoS trade-off, in my opinion.
Yeah, okay. Fair enough. Now, Tony also mentioned the Layer 3 routing engine, 160 gigabits per second. It's sort of an afterthought that Cisco put this functionality in here. If you're putting the Layer 3 routing engine into the 5548, it's a daughter card. So you still got your 48 ports in the front. If you're putting the Layer 3 engine into the 5596, you actually have to give up one of the three expansion slots for that card to be inserted into the chassis. So why the heck would you want 160 gigabit per second router and a 5500? There's use case for it. I'm actually in one right now where I'm dealing with a very small installation. 7000s were very expensive. I think there's a case to be made for the 5500's layer 3 engine in that case, but understand that it is feature limited. There's things you can't do with it. Like policy-based routing, I believe, is a limitation. WCCP isn't there. But for the rudimentary stuff that you would want in that engine, like EIGRP and OSPF and BGP, I believe all of that functionality is there, and it's certainly going to be suitable for those sorts of things. I guess there's a use case maybe for the Layer 3 engine in 5500 as an aggregation layer, like up from the core, but... people are starting to get away from designing data centers that way, so I don't know that that's the play you'd want to make with it.
You also lose ISSU, don't you?
Yeah, you do. You lose ISSU, so you can take two 5500s and have them be part of the same VPC domain, and they will talk to each other as you're doing a software upgrade, and ISSU... is broken, and so you have to plan your upgrades more carefully. If you've got a layer 3 engine in your 5500. So there's trade-offs there. At the same time, it's pretty short money. I think it it doesn't... I want to say List was like 10 or 11K for it, something like that.
Yeah. I also think the layer 3 engine does have a play if you're not, as you said, you're not quite ready for a 7000. Because the investment for a 7000 means a decent-sized data center infrastructure, typically. So if you want to prove it out, you can run the 5K, and once you add some more 5Ks is when you go to your 7K and you just move the 10 gig and you move your layer 3 and just move it up.
You know, and especially for a small site that's not ready for the 7K, 170 gigabits per second is nothing to sneeze at. That's kind of a lot of forwarding throughput for, again, for a smaller shop. If you're a great big data center, you're not thinking about this anyway. You just kind of snicker and move on, right? But if you're a small shop that's cost conscious, this is something worth looking at.
Yeah, or you're risk-averse of the 7K because you have a proven infrastructure of 6K that you have an investment in, and you're not ready for – they're not off the books yet. They're still on the books to be depreciated, and the county's not going to give you the money for the 7K. This may be something that gets you to those depreciation days.
Sure, yep.
Well, that was my manager hat on me. Yeah. That was scary.
Don't do that again, Jeff. What are you thinking?
Yeah. Go back to engineering. Stop managing the solution.
Oh. Now, I think another play worth mentioning here, Tony, is regarding how the 5Ks deal with FEX versus the 7K. Did you want to talk about that?
Honestly, I've never actually deployed 7K or FEXs with 7Ks. So I really can't speak towards that. Has anybody here actually done that?
Yeah, I can speak to it from a design perspective just because I happen to have been looking at this recently. If you talk to Cisco and you bring in the rep and they sit you down, and supposedly you'd be sitting them down, but usually it feels like they sit you down. Anyway, you gather around the whiteboard, and the design that's probably going to come out of that is you've got 7Ks at the bottom, 5Ks in the middle, and then 2Ks, the FEXs, the fabric extenders, hanging off of the 5Ks. And you might go, well, why? I can hang fabric extenders off of the Nexus 7000s, so why wouldn't I just go ahead and do that? And, you know, and it comes down to the fact that when you get into the fabric extenders, which we're actually going to talk about that in a bit, there are differences in the number of FEXs that you can hang off of each chassis, what line cards you can in a 7000 hang a FEX off of. And there's feature parity differences in the releases of NXOS, where the 5K seems to be the platform that has the leading FEX features, and the 7K tends to be playing catch up for that. So it's not a one for one no brainer. There are differences to be considered if FEX is part of your Nexus deployment strategy, and 5K is where the action is at. That's typically what you're going to do is hang 2Ks off of 5K. Like Tony said, he hasn't done it. And when he asked the question, have any of you guys done it, everyone was, you know, we got crickets. I just don't think it happens a lot.
The 7K can't support a VPC-attached FEX either, from what I understand.
Which would be a major design shortcoming, VPC being virtual port channel. And that would be, it would impact your redundancy design significantly. It would be something you'd need to understand. And
it's not a design for everyone, but if you wanted fabric extenders attached to two upstream switches, I don't think you can do it with the 7K.
Yeah. All right, we're going to talk about more about Fexes in a little bit, but I got a couple of, if you're on the Nexus page, you're actually looking at the product set. They've got a 4000 and they've got some 3000s, and I'm going to speak quickly to those. I'm not going to dwell on them a lot because they tend to be special use cases. The Nexus 4000 product line has one product, the Nexus 4001i switch module, which is a real specific fit. It's for an IBM Blade Center. So if you got a Blade Center H or HT chassis, you can pop in a Cisco Nexus 4001 switch module into this thing. If you want Nexus functionality right in the back of your IBM, again, H or HT Blade Center, this is a module worth looking at. It's high speed, low latency. It gives you 14 fixed 1 or 10 gig Ethernet ports, and then 6 fixed 1 or 10 gig Ethernet uplinks. So as you're plumbing that thing into the Blade Center chassis, you've got some that are facing the servers, and then you've got some that are facing upstream to hit the main network. And you've got a good bit of port density there. It does FCOE. It does data center bridging, DCB standard. So, again, something to be aware of. It's a niche play. If you're an IBM Blade Center shop, be aware that that card is out there as an option for you. The next line is a little more interesting, got a little bit broader of an appeal, but it's still a niche play, and that is the Nexus 3000 switches. The 3000s are, it's really Cisco trying to fill a product gap here where they didn't have an offering for top of rack that was matching up with what some of the other guys were doing. But they had the other guys, I'm talking specifically Arista, Juniper, IBM, Dell, HP, Alcatel-Lucent, all had offerings in this niche here, which is a merchant silicon-based, a Broadcom chip, a Trident chipset-based switch that's very low latency and targeted at high-frequency trading, people that are looking for ultra-low port-to-port latency. You know, we're talking less than a microsecond, measuring down into the nanosecond latency, and cramming a lot of ports into a very low rack unit density. There's three switches that fit in here. There's a 3064, a 3048, and a 3016. And if you think they're all like the same switch but with different port densities, not exactly. The 3048 is the odd man out here. And so actually, let me talk about that one first. The 3048 is a top-of-rack switch that's kind of like a lot of top-of-rack switches. It does 48 ports of plain old boring 10100 1000 gigabit Ethernet, and then it's got 4 10 gigabit Ethernet uplinks from that. It's going to be a play for guys doing big data, or maybe they're doing grid computing and have a lot of 1 gig they got to plumb, and they're still looking for the low latency, et cetera. That's the play there. Now, the other two switches, the 3064 and the 3016, are much closer related. As I was looking at the specs, it's kind of like, oh, this is almost the same switch, just plumbed a little different. So the 3064 does line rate, layer 2, layer 3, unicast and multicast. That translates to 1.2 terabits a second, 950 million packets per second if we're talking layer 3 forwarding. It's a 1RU switch. It's got 4 quad SFPs, QSFP plus, if you've seen that, to define an optic. Or so you can do 16, 10 gigabit Ethernet or 40 gigabit Ethernet uplinks. And the way this quad SFP works, the quad SFP is either 40 gig or it's 4 10 gig channels coming out of this, and there's some optical fan out cables that you can get to support this. It's kind of it's a different sort of an optic. Does 128K worth of MAC addresses, 4,096 LANs. It does 16,000 prefix routes, 16,000 host routes, and so on. So it's really, you can see positionally where the focus on being on the MAC addresses as opposed to routes, you're really positioning this thing layer 2 in the data center, east-west traffic, that sort of thing. That's where it's sitting. Now, the 3016, 16 QSFP plus ports, and again, each port being either a single 40 gigabit per second port or 4 10 gigabit per second ports. And again, the other thing, Cisco's really big on ASICs. They bake their own silicon. They design their own custom chipsets and silicone, have them manufactured and put into their switches, and that's their bread and butter. They've been doing that for a long time. So it is very notable that Cisco's getting into the merchant silicon market. In other words, go buy silicone that someone else made and put it in their switch. Again, this being Broadcom Trident chipset. So you're talking that this is a comparison against like an Arista 7050S-64. Juniper's QFabric Play, QFX 3500, it matches up really well against that. Really well. They're very comparable. I mean, it's basically the same guts on the inside, right? So it's hard to compare, well, which one's better? Well, how do they fit your software needs? You know, what vendor do you want to work with? The differences become semantics at a point. IBM's got a switch there, the rack switch, G8264. Dell just bought Force 10, and Force 10 selling the S4810 that fits in there. And there's others. So again, the 4000 kind of a niche play. The 3000 again is a bit of a niche play. And in talking to various Cisco guys, I don't think Cisco's pushing a lot of these out the door, but it is an interesting switch to be aware of and understand where it fits. Okay, so that was sort of a commercial break between the 7K, 5K, 2K conversation that we've mostly been having in this show. And Chris Margit, you want to talk for a bit about the 2000 FEXs and get into the different FEX modules?
Sure. So the Nexus 2K family is like a remote line card for the Nexus 5000 or, as we mentioned, the 7000. For the most part, you don't log into it as its own device. It appears... you know, just like a separate line card or a separate chassis in a switch stack. So it just looks like ports on the parent switch, but it has this structured cabling advantage that you can scatter them around your data center and put one or two or three in every server cabinet, which really changes the way your data center works, right? You no longer need, you know, hundreds and hundreds of pounds of copper cabling in the ceiling and, you know, massive patch panels everywhere. It cleans things up brilliantly.
Because the FEX backhaul is fiber optics.
The FEX backhaul is fiber, so you just drop a few fiber strands into every cabinet. You know, it's possible that servers with fiber channel storage are there already, and you already have fiber channel in these cabinets. And I love it. I think it's a great setup. So... the first FEX was the 2148, it's called, and that's a 48 gig copper ports and up to 40 gig of backlink or uplink, which gives it the same 1.2-to-1 oversubscription ratio as you might be accustomed to in a 6748 card and a catalyst. No reason to buy that thing anymore. It's been superseded by 2200 series FEXs. So the current family, we have... stuff with 1 gig ports facing the servers and 10 gig uplinks. And we have stuff with 10 gig ports facing the servers and 8 10 gig uplinks. The 48 ports or 24 ports on the server-facing side. On the 10 gig side, you can either have a SFP interface downlinking to the servers or 10G base T. That's a big decision point. You know, if you're going to deploy 10 gig servers, be sure to find out from the server guys whether they're buying servers with SFP interfaces or servers with 10G base T interfaces, because you're going to wind up building racks to support one or the other. In the 10 gig family, there's a model called the B22, which is actually a FEX blade for HP servers. It's got, I think, 80 gig of uplink and 16 server-facing interfaces.
That blade would be kind of like the IBM blade and that 4001i IBM blade I mentioned before. Like, this is a B22 and it goes into a C-class blade center from HP, I believe, right?
Exactly. It goes into the HP C-class, and the difference between that and the 4000 switch is that the 4000 is a full-blown switch, right, where this thing is a FEX, making it, you know, a component of a 5K.
Yes.
Which that's pretty super. I mean, you know, if you have HP C-class stuff now, you know, you've probably got maybe a Nortel switch or a Catalyst 3000 or something in those enclosures.
You have virtual to have a spanning tree.
I wasn't going to mention that. So anyway, you know, you have to have a spanning tree design all the way down to the server cabinet or rather the server enclosure. It adds an extra switching layer, and it just seems ugly. This B22 looks great. It's 2-to-1 oversubscribed, but, you know, 80 gig coming out of that chassis is pretty good, and you could put 8 of them in there if you wanted to, I guess. So anyway, there's a bunch of different models. In the 1 gig models and maybe the 10 gig, there's now a dash E option. That's a FEX with enhanced larger buffers, better interface counters, It's only a little more expensive, but it doesn't come in a bundle, which is the way you want to buy this stuff. So since that one forces you into a la carte purchasing, it actually turned out to be a lot more expensive. There's also this this rumor of a PoE fix. If you go into the command line on a 5K running new software, it knows about a fabric extender with PoE, which, you know, makes me wonder about, you know, goodness, would people be deploying these things to IDF closets and, you know, run your whole building as one switch?
I don't know about that. That's an odd play to me.
But security cameras would make sense.
It is, but, you know, what's the... That's a weird setup. Anyway, I've heard that will not be seeing the light of day, but the code knows about it, so that's kind of interesting. And then there's a couple of other things called AdapterFex and VMFex. These are NICs that go in servers that it seems to be that they instantiate themselves as many PCI devices, and you can run a single cable to your server, have the server think it's got several NICs. The switch shows several switch ports, one for each NIC. That gives you some new, interesting, flexible options with reduced cabling.
Yeah, there are some Cisco blogs on this VMFex topic, the AdapterFex and VMFex topics both, that cover this in some detail. There's a lot to wrap your brain around exactly what's going on here and why you should care. It is a bit of a complex topic.
The VMFex is especially neat, in my opinion, because it lets you eliminate the vSwitch. You know, it'll map every virtual machine straight to a port on the upstream Nexus 5000. There's no layer 2 switching within the hypervisor anymore, which that's pretty nice. AdapterFex, I guess, is standards-based. It's 802.1BR stuff, and Cisco supports a Broadcom NIC as an AdapterFex, or at least that's my understanding. That's pretty cool. All of these fabric extenders, the part number tells you, you know, how many server-facing interfaces it has, and also the style of uplink and downlink. So you'll see stuff like 2248 TP, 2232 TM, 2232 PP. Those letters, P tells you that it's a pluggable, an SFP, or an SFP plus. The T means it's got twisted pair interfaces, so, you know, regular copper RJ45 cable. An F tells you that the unit comes bundled with FET transceivers. That's an SFP module. And the M represents the modular uplink on the 2232 TM. So 2232 TM, 10G base T downlinks, that's the T, modular uplink.
Now the FET is a special case which is worth talking about in some detail.
FET is cool stuff, absolutely. You know, building a 10 gig link is expensive. List price, you know, with a couple of SFP plus modules, one link costs $3,000 list. FET accomplishes pretty much the same task over multimode fiber for closer to $500.
Yeah, it's a special optic. I want to say Greg Farrell managed to confirm that this thing was basically a short reach Ethernet optic, but it's a special case the way Cisco bundles it. You can't use it in just anything. You can't even buy it as a single part number. You can only buy it as part of a FEX bundle. If you try to use it for an application other than uplinking effects, it doesn't work. The optics are detected by the Nexus as, hey, that's a FET, you can't do that.
That's exactly right. It doesn't even work on all the FEXs. It's not supported by the 2148T. But yeah, it's a great choice. I like those things quite a bit. You know, we used to build these infrastructure with TwinX cable between the 5K and the 2K, which forced you to put the 5K, you know, near the servers and then use the up to 5 meter or now 10 meter cables. You know, the FET changes everything because it means you can stick a fabric extender anywhere you need to in your data center, which is a huge advantage, especially when it comes to migrating off of legacy switching platforms and onto this new stuff. You don't need to move servers necessarily. You can just put Nexus ports where you need them.
Now, you've had some challenges with FEXs getting hot.
Have I ever? So the all this Nexus stuff is optimized to be installed with servers. So the airflow works with the servers, which means exhaust is on the port side of the chassis. That is the 5K and the 2K. So 5K ingests air from the cold side of the cabinet, blows it out the hot side of the cabinet where the ports are, where the back of the server is, and so forth. The 2K Same story, except the 2K is very short. It's only like 20 inches deep, which means its intake is in the middle of the cabinet. And it's hot in the middle of the cabinet. So, you know, I've had literally hundreds of faxes in temperature alarm running super hot, and there was nothing you could do about it for a while. Then Panduit introduced a duct that extends the fax all the way to the cold side of the cabinet. That's great, but it doubled the size. And
yeah, right. It was like this 2U down to 1U kind of a sleeve.
Exactly, yeah. It was a 2U sleeve that the fax fit inside of. It, you know, cost kind of a lot compared to the cost of a fax. Was impossible to retrofit because it, you know, required you to move things around in the cabinet and eliminate the install hardware and all that stuff. Cisco has just introduced, I've never seen one, but I've seen pictures of it, a new thing called the NXA-Airflow-SLV, which is a sheet metal box that extends the fax all the way to the cold side of the cabinet. It's pretty inexpensive, and it's a must-buy option, in my opinion.
You can actually order that now. For a while, it was like one of these mystery things. I go to my rep and say, hey, can I get this part now? They didn't know what I was talking about, but it's out there now. You can get it. You know what? We talked about the FETs. I mean, Tony, why don't you just give us an overview of some of the other optics? Because optics is a big part of this design. And I shouldn't say optics. I really should say SFP Plus modules. While there certainly are an awful lot of optical modules, there's also copper modules that come in a lot cheaper. You would just want to take us through just kind of a quick overview of the optics and the caveats of buying one versus the other?
Sure. Chris got a little bit into the TwinAx connectors. For those of you that don't know, TwinAx is basically a copper coaxial cable with SFP Plus plugs on either side. They come in a variety of lengths, 1, 3, and 5 meter passive cables, which are more supported in most of Cisco's gear, and then 7 meter and 10 meter active cables, which are less supported in some gear, and I've recently been brought to my attention more supported in others. When you're looking to connect anything with TwinAx, it's highly recommended that you research it, make sure that it's going to be supported. You can run passive cables to, you know, non-Cisco gear. If you have, you know, a NetApp storage controller, you can connect it via, you know, a 5 meter passive cable, but 5 meters away, you know, how close is your storage head to your your Nexus 5000? So, keeping with copper, we also have some copper X2 modules. Actually, probably the very first 10 gig copper interface was the CX4, the InfiniBand cable. Those are supported up to 15 meters on X2. And now that's Nexus 7000 only, actually the M108 card only. We also have the X2 10 gig T, which does up to 100 meters on Cat 6A or Cat 7. And something called the Cisco 1X converter module, which lets you run TwinAx in an M108 X2 port.
That X2 form factor isn't overly popular. You see it here and there, but I was thinking I have some X2s in an older 6500 card. But man, they're big and they're heavy, and you can't cram a lot of them in there. But yeah, they're still around.
If I remember correctly, I think that 1X actually works in the 6Ks, because I know recently Cisco had some issues getting 10 gig optics, and we were looking for alternatives, and that's one of the options we looked at, was getting one of those 1X type connectors to go to SFP Plus. There's those we could get.
Yeah, I actually I use X2 in my 7Ks at my primary 8-5, and then I also use them in my 3750Es, which we're using in some places for Metro E switches. It really just depends on what your end goal is. We ended up using the M108 cards because, you know, they're line rate, they're not oversubscribed. Don't have to worry about that. So when we get into fiber, we have a lot, and I do mean a lot of options. If we start with X2, we have pretty much every flavor of fiber you want. LRM, LX4, you know, your standard SR, then long reach, LR, ER, ZR, all of those are supported. Depending on what you're trying to connect, you really need to make sure that you have the correct modules for distance, for the type of fiber. Obviously, the long reach stuff is all single mode. you know, kind of do your research before you start planning all this stuff out. Obviously, that's the same for anything you're doing when we're talking about Nexus. As far as SFP modules, we have the same exact set. We have the SR. We do have an SRX, which operates in extended temperature ranges. But we also have the LRM modules, LR, LRX, and of course, you know, that's another extended temperature module, ER and ZR optics, which go up to 80 kilometers.
Yeah, all of those going. I mean, in a data center, typically it's going to be at the SR, the short haul that you're going to be running.
Yeah, yeah, that's pretty much all you're going to see in a data center, unless you're connecting into your Metro E, if you have dark Metro E, you know, between data centers.
Yeah, but, yeah, right. The longer haul ones are going to be, that's more of the carrier service provider play. And again, data center stuff is going to be, again, the short haul stuff, or as Chris was talking before, the FETs, for interconnecting between the FEXs and 5Ks. And the cost on these is another thing. I mean, you start pricing out like a short haul optic list for, no one pays list, but right. A short haul optic is, $14.95, I believe. Not inconsiderable. So, I mean, times two to get one on the other end, and you're into, again, list, you're pushing $3,000 U.S. dollars to terminate a piece of fiber. It's a good bit of change.
Filling a 7K card with links, with optics for both ends, can cost twice what the card cost.
Yeah.
Yep.
And that's, I mean, the cards aren't cheap, so... You know, that's the reason that the FET and the twin axe and whatnot is so compelling. But you got to locate all the equipment carefully and, you know, plan things out.
If you can take advantage of twin axe or FETs, do it everywhere you can. Try to save that money. There's no difference between running an SR optic and a FET or twin axe. So do it wherever you can. Try to save that money. Research any cards you're going to deploy with any optics you're going to deploy. Make sure they are supported. There are, unfortunate circumstances where the optic you need and the card you have just aren't going to work. I found that over and over again.
And to speak to what Chris was pointing out before, when you're budgeting this project, don't overlook the optics or don't overlook the interconnects if they're not necessarily optics, even if they're copper, because it can be a very considerable cost that's added to the project overall. And if you think, oh, yeah, we'll put some optics in there, I mean, what's the big deal? Dollar-wise, very big, potentially. So something for sure to think about. That's really kind of a change if you're used to the catalyst mindset where, oh, I'm just going to plug in a bunch of copper. And, yeah, structured cabling costs money, but it wasn't a deal-breaker, and you can buy patch cables pretty cheap if you wanted to, and so on. This is a different thing when you're pushing optical fiber optics around your data center. Now it's a different mindset, something you got to think about and be responsible for and make sure you budget carefully. You're not just going to buy that line card, slam it full of optics and go, I don't know if I'm going to need them or not, but I'm just going to buy them full. Probably that's going to break the budget, and it's something you got to think about carefully.
It also comes down to line card limitations. As was said before, dedicated and shared mode on some of your ports. Well, how many optics do you really need?
If you're going to run the card in non-blocking mode, right, and therefore you only need a quarter of the optics, that's a pretty different use case than putting a 32-port card full of optics. Jeff, why don't we wrap this thing up with just a brief overview of licensing? Because, you know, if there's one thing Cisco's gotten extraordinarily good at in the last few years, it's is different licensing bundles that are required to turn on different feature sets within the piece of hardware that you've purchased. And with the Nexus stuff, there's a whole lot of stuff to be aware of. And, you know, we're not going to deep dive everything about licenses, but Jeff, if you just give us kind of a quick overview of the things that we should be thinking about going into a Nexus plan, that'd be useful.
Yeah, I was looking at the licenses, and it's mind-boggling how much license options there are on some of these things. They've broken it out in the typical Cisco recent fashion. It's just not as bad as voice, so we're good there.
that's small comfort, but okay, we'll take it.
You get a base license with the 7K, covers most of your layer 2, spanning tree, VLANs, PVLANs, UDLD. If you want to do like layer 3, OSPF, routing protocols, BGP, EIGRP, ISIS, heck, if you want to do multicast, you need to get the enterprise license. And if you want to run VDCs and even Cisco TrustSec, you need the advanced LAN license. So it just keeps piling upon, so you got to keep building your licenses based on what you need. Cisco's also got a transport services license that covers your OTV, and in newer releases now even enables Lisp for those people who are crazy enough to do that stuff. Of course, I like Lisp, so I won't even go there. There is a license if you want to run the DCNM, the Data Center Network Management Support software for this. As Chris mentioned earlier, you have the XL feature scalable license based upon the chassis you have. And then I also found things for licenses for if you want FabricPath. There's a license for that. MPLS, there's a license for that. And if you want to do storage, there's a license for that. They license everything, basically, it seems like. But at the same time, though, if you don't need a feature, you don't have to buy a license for it. So how many use cases for Lisp and OTV are probably still new, so it kind of makes sense that people aren't playing with it and breaking their data center because they, oh, we have this new feature, let's try it. How many people ever, nobody ever does that, do they?
There's pros and cons, right, with the licensing model. Obviously, Cisco's got to make their money, and you know, software is their intellectual property, and so they're going to do licenses. It's fair.
Right, but there is, if there is a feature you want to try, you do have a license grace period command that gives you a 120-day license for any feature you do want to try.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's cool.
Yeah, it's, the command is license space grace period, and it'll enable the licenses. Only enabled for the default VDC, though, the first one. So it's just the one little section.
If you want to try FabricPath or something, it sounds like, you know, turn it up in your lab before you, you know, move these devices into production. You could do that, not have to pay for it. Or then make the choice, I like this, I want to do this, and then buy it. That's cool.
Oops, I forgot to order that and I need it. Put the PO in, but we're using it.
Some of those licenses are a la carte, and others require, you know, others are building blocks to other licenses. So, you know, there are cases where, oh, I want to try this one thing, and, oh, I have to, I thought it was a $5,000 license, but I need this other $20,000 license first.
Yeah, like the Advanced, I know, builds off Enterprise, which builds off Base, if I remember correctly. Right, Advanced builds off Enterprise, VDCs. It gets confusing fast with the licenses. You're better off asking your Cisco SE, which ones do you need sometimes?
Yeah, and like the FabricPath one interested me, even though it was a small deployment. I'm kind of keen on Trill, and it was pricey. I don't remember the specifics anymore, but it was. I mean, when I was talking to him in the in the little conference room, we were discussing it, and I said, "Well, what if I want to do FabricPath?" And they kind of both looked at me sideways. Yeah, I don't think you want to do that. It's gonna break your budget. So yeah. I kind of left it alone, which was a bummer. But
yeah, I know right now Cisco's got a special. I think it's almost all the licenses. There's a special bundle price. I know when I saw the bundle price, I almost had a heart attack. I think it was $75,000 list. Thank God nobody pays list. But I know it's not cheap, but it's got all. I think it comes with almost all the licenses, if not all of them.
Hmm.
So it's kind of. So if you, it almost is. If you're building a 7000, you need everything. Then again, what's that on a Nexus 7000? Anyways, it's a drop in the hat, right? It's a line card.
That's actually kind of a compelling bundle at that price. It makes you think about it. Maybe I should just buy them all.
Yeah, especially knowing the discounts that I get and other companies get, it's kind of like, well, it's not as bad as it really thinks if it does all this stuff or gives me these features. It also opens up a ticking time bomb because suddenly people can help play with stuff they shouldn't.
Well, is the 5,000 license kind of the same way the 7,000 is, or...?
It seems to be a little bit different because that's more of a layer 2 device. You do have a storage port license. I think it's an 8-port minimum license you have to buy to enable FC or FCOE. Again, there's a fabric server license for the 5K, and then there's a layer 3 license if you want to do the layer 3 features, which also means you got to buy the layer 3 line card, which if you get the layer 3 license, it gives you all the RIP and OSPF and EIGRP stubs and HSRP and every other acronym we can throw in there for a while.
Yeah, not just stubs, but fully EIGRP also with the right license, yeah.
Yeah, I think the fully EIGRP comes in there, sorry, you're right. OSPF routes unrestricted.
Ethan, to your point about the, you know, maybe I should just buy these licenses now. Just recently I went through this with a customer that had passed on the OTV bonus pricing or, you know, the inexpensive pricing with their new switches, and a few months later decided, oh, we think we want to try OTV. And, you know, then came the sticker shock of, since you didn't buy it with the bundle, here's the full price version of that license.
A la carte is not necessarily your friend. Oh, you know what, Jeff? I was just looking back at the license notes here. There's two flavors of license for that layer 3 functionality in the 5500. Again, we're belaboring something that most people aren't going to be buying, but...
Yeah, the one that comes with the card, and if you want the advanced features, it's the other license that you need.
And it's kind of like a Catalyst 3750, you know, if you get the one level, you just get EIGRP stub, and then you buy the advanced one, whatever the name of it is, I've forgotten, and you get full EIGRP. So again,
yeah, the Enterprise gives you the full EIGRP and everything else. Yep. And the next, the 3000, again, probably one of those things that people won't see, but there's a base layer 3 services license you can get that gives you RIP, EIGRP stub, and then there's the Enterprise that gives you all the wonderful features, just like the other ones. And the Nexus 2000 is licensed based off what the parent has, since everything's controlled by either the 5K or the 7K.
Yeah, so you don't have to license the 2K per se. It just, whatever it's plugged into is what it can do.
Correct.
Because technically it isn't doing anything.
It's doing what it's told.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Well, let's wrap this up with some more odds and ends here. Just real quick, one thing is the Nexus 1000V. That is not hardware. It is software. It is... and we've actually covered various aspects of the Nexus 1000V on other podcasts, some of which Cisco has sponsored. So I'm not going to belabor that too much. It is a play for VMware and for Hyper-V shops who are looking for embedded switch functionality as a software switch. That is really what the play is there. The components that make it up, a virtual Ethernet module, again, that's the software switch that's embedded in the hypervisor, and a virtual supervisor module, which manages your policies, QoS, etc. And it gives you, you end up marrying a switch port profile to a virtual machine, so if you move that virtual machine around somewhere else, the switch port profile goes with it. And Cisco is also positioning 1000V that you can put other services on top of it, like their virtual security gateway, which is effectively ASA virtualized on top of 1000V to give you firewall functionality, for example. So we won't, you know, it's kind of not a fit for what we're describing here, because when you're talking about a data center hardware build out with 7K, 5K, and 2K, the 1000V is, it's a different solution that fits in a different place. From that perspective. That said, it is part of the product family and it is the same operating system. And of course, it is going to play in your data center. It's just a little out of the sphere of the designs that, that we're going to be focusing on as we talk. And then a comment on management software and it did come up before. There is a piece of software Cisco offers here to manage the Nexus world called the Data Center Network Manager, and it's got two components. DCNM has got a LAN component and a SAN component, and there was a piece of software called the Fabric Manager that it looks like Cisco, as of Nexus 5, NXOS 5.2, they've moved the Fabric Manager product into the DCNM family and are calling it DCNM SAN. So you got DCNM LAN and DCNM SAN. Let's presume they work together in perfect harmony and just make managing your data center and Nexus gear wonderful. I've got a screenshot that I'm looking at that was on Cisco's marketing data sheets for this. And it looks, you know, you've got a dashboard, sort of a component. It kind of feels a little bit more like what the new Cisco Prime stuff has got. And so if that interests you, you've got a whole bunch of Nexus gear in your data center you're looking at managing and monitoring, DCNM is probably something that you would be interested in looking at, understanding that there is a license component for the hardware that is tied to that. Okay, and with that, we have gone on for 90 minutes of stuff about the Cisco Nexus platform. And again, this is just us customers and our experience, and what we've learned as we've been dealing with this platform. This was not a sponsored show. This is nobody looking. It's just us engineer guys in a room. Let's talk, you know, kind of a conversation about Nexus. So let's call it a show. This was a lot. This was a lot. So, I mean, Mr. Margaret, I thank you very much for joining us, Chris. And what are you going to be working on this week?
Thanks for having me. Nice to be back with you again. I'm actually planning to stand up a bunch of Nexus gear next week.
Awesome.
seven pairs of 5500s and a whole bunch of 2000s hanging from that.
And Jeff Fry, the same for you. I'm curious what you'll be working on this week.
I got a couple ASR 9000 deployments. I've been playing with them lately, building out a data center for the company in a foreign location, so dealing with time zone differences and cultural differences. But it's actually kind of the fun part. And building a raised garden with my neighbor. Trying to get that finished up before I go in for knee surgery next week. Fun, oh. fun.
I mean, does the raised garden have Ethernet ports on it? What are you doing?
Yeah, he used to have a really ugly garden, so we decided to build a raised garden so his wife doesn't have to bend over and hurt her back when she does gardening. So I think it's 24 feet by 18 feet tall, wide, I mean, and about 2 foot tall.
That sounds like a really cool project. Apparently there's things to do outside of computers. Who knew?
I've seen the pictures of it, and it looks like a sore back.
It's 6x6s do get heavy after a while, but you know something? In our world, we don't get too often actually use our hands to build things. It's usually racking, stacking, and then configuring, so I'm kind of enjoying this.
That's cool. Now, speaking of racking and stacking, Tony, you were talking about having a rack Nexus 7000 chassis by yourself. Well, if you've ever met Tony, he's one of the guys that I think could do it. He's a tall guy for sure. A lot of meat on him. So, Tony, what are you going to be working on this week?
We're getting to the point now where we're finally playing catch-up, so... Very little technology for me this week. I'm actually going to be concentrating on wrapping things up with trying to buy this house. So,
oh, first house?
Yep, my first house.
Oh, welcome to the club, sir.
Thank you.
It's good and horrible all at the same time. Thank you for listening to the show this week, everyone. You can follow the Packet Pushers on Twitter at Packet Pushers. And, of course, visit packetpushers.net and keep up with what's going on there. We have new bloggers that we continue to add. Russ White has joined us as a new blogger and is starting to put content on the feed. Just for example, there's a lot of great stuff to read out there. So I hope you don't just listen to the podcast, but also, you know, get more engrossed in what a lot of other folks are offering with the blogs that are on the site. And of course, if you do go up to the site, you can subscribe to RSS feeds. You could donate to the show if you like. And if you would, email your comments or questions about this show to packetpushers@gmail.com. And finally, remember that too much networking would never be enough.